session number 18676, Reel 10.
About the beginning of October, I think it was somewhere around about the first weekend in October, we closed down and we moved up forward, right forward, and we remained closed. And we were also transferred from 30 Corps to 10 Corps. Now 10 Corps was an armoured corps. It had, I think, three armoured divisions, and we were transferred to them. And 23rd of October, the real Battle of Alamein started. And for the first 10 days, it was chiefly artillery and infantry. The sappers had a tremendous job to do trying to clear a path through the very, very extensive minefields, and it was just a slow slog. And all told, we suffered 14,000 casualties there in 10 days. The breakthrough came, and once the sappers and the infantry had forced their way through the minefields, then that opened up the way for the armour to get through. Montgomery wasn't going to risk losing his armour on minefields. And until there was a clear passage through, well, more than one clear passage, of course, but until there was these passages cleared right the way through, he didn't commit his armour. But when he did, it was an absolute, what can you say, hell for leather chase to get through these minefields. And they were extensive. I should say that they extended at least 5 or 6 miles or more deep. And it was organised chaos. It was organised, but my God, you've never seen naught like it. There was literally hundreds of tanks charging through these gaps in the minefield. And when it came dark, which was fairly early then, it was round about, if I remember right, somewhere around about 6 or 7, 6 o'clock, they kept them going by firing BOFA anti-aircraft guns at each side of the opening through the minefield, each of these openings. And these BOFA guns were trained down the line of the gap, and they were firing tracer shells. And what the armour was doing was going through in between these two rows of tracers. And they kept that up all night to get as much armour through as they could. And about 4 o'clock in the morning, it was our turn. And we went through this gap, mixed up with the armoured corps, the tanks, and the support troops. And it was terrifying. It literally was. And if you strayed off the line of these tracer shells, you'd had it, because it was absolutely littered with mines. Anyway, we got through, and the armour started fanning out. And what the infantry had done, any real strong points of the Jerrys, they'd bypass them. And most of the armour went straight after Jerry's armour, but some of them were used to mop up these pockets of resistance. And one of the strongest was a place called Thompson's Post on the coast road. And that held out for 8 days. Intense shelling and air attacks and everything else, and the Jerrys held out for 8 days. We were ordered to close, because we had opened up, and we were ordered to close and move into this Thompson's Post as soon as it was cleared. which we did. And we got there just about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And as I say, we had 60-odd wagons. And the CO had planted his little flag on the side of the road where we had to turn off. And we started turning off and everybody was getting in to the site. And then one or two of the wagons started taking a shortcut. Instead of going up as far as the flag and turning, they were cutting across off the road and straight into the site. Anyway, about five wagons came through that way, and then, of course, the sixth one hit a landmine. So that put an end to them cutting across to get into the site instead of coming up as far as the flag. Luckily, we didn't lose any men. We lost a wagon, but we didn't lose any men. After Thompson's Post, we moved up. And this is the view of Saloon Bay, taken from the top of the escarpment. When we got to the top of the Saloon escarpment, because of course that was a bottleneck, and it was strictly regulated what time you went up, we got to the top and went as far as Capuzzo, which was the Italian strong point in the first push. And the CO went to divisional headquarters for orders on where we had to open up. Anyway, he came back about 11 o'clock in the morning, and the order was that we had to proceed with all speed to Tobruk and open up immediately. So the old man gave us the instruction that we're to get to Tobruk. And it was right up the RESC driver's alley was this. Instead of going in convoy, which we normally did, and especially on the coast road where you were strictly limited for space, it was individuals get there as quick as you can and open up immediately. The old man set off in his staff car, and the RASC drivers made hay while the sunshine. They were in and out of traffic and convoys like school kids let loose. We got to Tobruk just as it was coming dark, and as each wagon came in, the old man was there and he had his little flag up and everything else, so everybody knew where they had to go from that. And we started opening up. Well, by the time we'd got the first tents off the wagon, before ever they were erected, it was dark. And yet, by 10 o'clock that night, we were fully opened and receiving patients. It was incredible how it was done. But by God, it was done. This is a view of Tobruk Harbour. And it was a complete wreck, was the harbour installations. This is me at Tobruk in November 1952. And it was a very unhealthy place to be where we were. We'd opened up where we were told to open up. But if you can imagine a triangle with the sides about 10 miles long, we're in the middle between the port of Tobruk, El Adam Aerodrome, and the railhead that had been extended from Mirza Matru up to Tobruk. And was a favourite place for Jerry bombers at night. Very unhealthy. This is a sergeant's mess at Tobruk. And from left to right, it's back row, Bob Reed. The next man, I'm afraid I can't remember his name. He was an RE sapper. And then we come to Sergeant Haswell, third along, then myself, then Hoppy Lloyd, Sergeant Lloyd. Next to him is Wally Hammond, the orderly room sergeant. And the end man on the back there, I'm afraid I can't tell you his name at all. I think he was just detached, or rather attached to us for about a week. And then in front row is left to right, Bob Fife, Ted Gray, Sergeant Major Williams, and QSM Dickie Armour. This is Dickie Armour, the QSM, stirring the bully stew. This is Sergeant Reed with some of his cooks with the captured German cookhouse. Very elegantly dressed. There we are again. Stop for a meal on the way up. This would be after we left Tobruk. I can see there's Bloomfield on the left, and next to him is Tommy Oxen. This is Sergeant Bob Reed, the cook in our bivvy. These bivvies took two men, and you used to have to dig in if you could. And as I say, they took two men. You couldn't do anything in them at all. It was just simply a question of down on the deck and sleep. They were too low to do anything with. This is us digging in when we arrived at a new location. I'm watched by Jack Tate, Ronnie Wellband, a Private Ward, aye, that's right, but the one in the distance near the car, I just can't make him out. This is me with some of the operating room staff. You can see in the background here, we've got the bivvies up. This is me outside the admission and discharge, well, not discharge, evacuation tent during the push. This is me caught in the act, nose to the grindstone. Paperwork. Mountains of it. This is Jimmy Douglas. He was an orderly room clerk. And we're handling that many casualties that just couldn't keep up with the paperwork, so they had to let me have Douglas from the orderly room permanently. And the only way we could possibly keep up with it was for Jimmy Douglas to do permanent nights, and he used to spend 9 hours a night doing nothing else but complete a form called the A35. It was an army form, and it showed every patient that you got in, his rank, his name, his army number, his diagnosis, where it come from, and where we disposed of him, where we evacuated him to. And that return had to go in every week, and there was four copies. There was one to Div, one to Cor, one to GHQ, and one to Army Council in England. And no matter how good you were, with your nose to grindstone, if you could keep up 35 entries an hour, you were doing very well. It was a very detailed form, was that. And it had to be accurate, because the casualty returns were based on it. And also, every dangerously ill and seriously ill patient, he had to be included. And he had an asterisk against his name, so that they could follow him up, because with DI and SI patients, as we call them, you had to put a return in every 24 hours. This is another sandstorm, but it is after we'd left Tobruk on our way up. Not such a dramatic picture as the other one, but those lines across the photograph, they aren't scratches. That's the sand blowing, and you can see the wagon there has lost its canopy, so it'll give you some idea of the strength of the wind. Made it very, very uncomfortable. This is another shot of the cookhouse after the men had been served. As you can see, there ain't much left. This is a sergeant's mess. Here we're just nicely crossed into Tunisia. And we're behind the Marath line. And in this photograph from left to right, we've got back row, Sergeant Bloomfield, Sergeant Fife, Sergeant Willie Wilton. Now, he's a new one. He was a Scarborough bloke, by the way, lived in Britannia Street. Myself, Wally Hammond, Bob Reed, Sergeant Lloyd, RESC, Haswell, and Hoppy Lloyd. And front row, Ted Gray, Sergeant Major Williams, Lieutenant Colonel Sandyman Allen, the new Quartermaster Sergeant, and I just can't think of his name, and then Staff Sergeant Finbow. Wilton, Finbow, and the new QMS. This was a result of trying to change over staff. We'd been up the blue and in what you call frontline service for so long that they decided that they had to change us over to give us a rest, and also to let some of these other people who'd done nothing else but wallow in base get some battle experience. And this was the result. And it was successful up to a point, but I don't know, they just didn't seem to integrate, didn't these people, with the same spirit as what the original chaps did. And I forgot to mention, while we were at base in Egypt, Colonel Wade was given a post in England, and we got this new CO here, Colonel Lieutenant Colonel Sandyman Allen. He was a very good CO, typical hunting, shooting, fishing type. But he was a good CO, and if you had any problems, you could always go to him. The one fad he had, and it didn't matter what happened, he insisted it. When we were in operation, he insisted our evacuation that the last ambulance left our casualty clearing station by 7:30 in the morning. It didn't matter what time I had to order the ambulances for, or how many men I had to put on stretcher bearer duty for getting them out of the ward and into the ambulance. The last ambulance had to leave at 7:30, and you can bet your bottom dollar at 7:30 he would emerge from the orderly room and come across to my A&D tent where all the ambulances had to report both in and out. And his first words always were, "Last ambulance away, Sergeant." Well, when we were at Tobruk, this is just by the way, the New Zealand casualty clearing station, which was about 4 miles away, they received their sisters. So with that, Montgomery said, if they can have the sisters, we can have the sisters. So just as we were ready to move up the line from Tobruk, we got the sisters. And my God, what a pain in the neck they were. You've no idea the extra work it caused. I mean, as you're moving about, you know, moving up or anything like that, I mean, the convoy would stop, say, every hour and a half, and everybody would just jump off like and relieve themselves. Disappear with a shovel if it was for that end, if it was just urinating, that was it. But of course, as soon as we got the sisters, oh no, they had to have a tent erected, a bell tent, for their lavatory. And a separate cook. Oh, it caused no end of trouble. Anyway, they arrived just as we were moving. And we opened up, and the first morning everything went all right. The sisters weren't on the wards. And the second morning we had rather a big evacuation. I think we had about 190 odd patients to get out. So I arranged, I had a running liaison with the RAC regarding motor ambulance convoys and such like, and he used to work out late at night how many we had to go, how many were sitting cases, how many were stretcher cases, order the correct number of ambulances, and tell them the time that we needed them. Well, I could see with this lot we were going to be a bit pushed to get them away for 7:30. So I said we would have a 4:45 start. Well, the ambulances arrived all right, and what I used to do, I used to have chits made out for each ambulance, which ward he had to go to and what he had to pick up. If it was all sitting cases, it would be 8 sitting cases. If it was stretcher cases, it would be 4 stretcher cases and 2 sitting cases, one in the back and one up front. And I had it all worked out like this, and as each ambulance came, I gave him a chit. As he came back, he handed that chit in to me, and I could see how the evacuation was going. Well, this morning, it wasn't going at all. Oh, dear, from the officer's ward, I hadn't had an ambulance by 7 o'clock. And also from surgical one and medical one, they were very slow. So I got Sergeant Hodgson just to take over from me for seeing to the ambulances while I went to see what it was held up. Well, you've never seen such a carry on these sisters were doing in the wards in all your life. And I just said to them, I says, look, sister, I says, you can't do this. I says, I've got to have my last ambulance away by 7:30. It was, oh, would you like this, especially in officers' wards, would you like this, would you like a drink of tea before you go and all this? Anyway, I found this was the same. Wherever there was a delay, it was the sisters. So I got back to the A&D tent and took over from Tommy Hodgson again. And there was about 15 ambulances adrift at 7:30, and the old man appeared out of the blue as usual. All the ambulances away. I said, no, sir. I said, I'm afraid we've got a hold up. So I said, what's the hold up? And I told him. Right. Leave this one with me. And away it went. And then, sure enough, about 5 minutes later, the ambulances started arriving. And I found out afterwards they'd gone into each of the wards where the sisters were and take them off the wards. Told them to go to the sisters' mess and to stop there until the evacuation was over. And then later in that morning, it had all the sisters, including the senior sister, and explained to them exactly what it meant to be up forward and trying to keep the line of evacuation open, that we just hadn't time for niceties. You moved the patients out as fast as you could. You made sure they were comfortable. Everybody had had his treatment. If he'd been operated on, his proper medication, morphia or whatever he wanted for his journey. And that was it. But oh dear, the sisters took very, very badly to it, and I'm afraid we took very badly to the sisters. This is the grave of Marco, the dog. We picked him up somewhere around about Tobruk way, and of course it was all us very friendly with the cooks. Anyway, poor old Marco, after we crossed into Tunisia, the first place we opened up, he got killed running across the road, because the tarmac road right from Alexandria was still continuing right the way up to Tunisia, and he got hit by a lorry and it killed him. Fortunately, it killed him outright. This is the grave of Marco the dog again, over the border into Tunisia. This is just a view of the sea up near Sfax. This campaign was now nearing its end. The 8th and the 1st Army had joined forces, and they were squeezing the Jerry right up into the top peninsula of Tunisia. And we had reached a place called Sfax in the Gulf of Syrtes. All of us remember the first time I came across an officer of the 1st Army. As you can see from the previous photographs, we were a very slap-happy army as regards dress. Anything went. As long as you could fight and do your job, that was all that was required. Well, this officer, it was just as though it stepped out of a Bond Street shop window. He was immaculate. And he took one look at me and he says, whose army are you in? I said, 8th Army, what army are you in? And he took exception to that and he reported me to the CO for being insolent. Anyway, CO didn't make anything about it, this Sanderman Allen. He just said, oh, we're dealing with a different breed of officer now. He says, you'll just have to be a bit careful how we handle them. Anyway, as I say, we got to Sfax. And then it was, they pulled us out. And we went back to Tripoli. And we were put in a transit camp and we were hanging around there, I think for nearly a week, awaiting a ship to take us back down to Egypt. This is us on the beach at Tripoli, waiting orders to move where we were going, etc. Left to right, it's Staff Sergeant Ball, myself, and Sergeant Major Taffy Williams. This is a bit of the coastline at Tripoli, where we used to go bathing. Mrs. is on the beach at Tripoli again. Left to right, back rights, Sergeant Bob Reid, then the new quartermaster sergeant whose name I can't remember, Sergeant Major Williams, myself, Sergeant Hoppy Lloyd, and then front row is Billy Bloomfield, Haswell, Sergeant Haswell, and Staff Sergeant Gray, Ted Gray.